It's Wednesday, October 29th. This is a reading of the Arizona Daily Star. Here on Sun Sounds of Arizona, Mark DeGroft with you. From Washington, the U.S. military has carried out three strikes in the eastern Pacific Ocean against boats accused of carrying drugs, killing 14 people and leaving one survivor, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth announced on Tuesday. This was the first time multiple strikes were announced in a single day. Carried out on Monday, the strikes mark a continued escalation in the pace of the attacks in the South American waters, which began in early September and has been spaced weeks apart. A statement provided by a Pentagon official, who spoke on the condition of anonymity to freely discuss the operation, said that the strikes were conducted off the coast of Colombia. Following one attack on a boat, the military spotted a person in the water clinging to some wreckage. The military passed the survivor's precise location to the United States Coast Guard and a Mexican military aircraft that was operating in the area. Hegseth said the Mexican search and rescue authorities assumed responsibility for coordinating the rescue of the sole survivor, but didn't say if that person was successfully rescued or would stay in Mexico's custody or be handed over to the United States. In a strike earlier this month with two survivors, the U.S. military rescued the pair and repatriated them to Colombia and Ecuador. Authorities released the Ecuadorian man after prosecutors said that they had no evidence that he had committed a crime in Ecuador. Hegseth posted footage of the latest strikes to social media, in which two boats can be seen moving through the water in separate clips. One is visibly laden with a large amount of parcels or bundles. Both then suddenly explode and are seen in flames. The third strike appears to have been conducted on a pair of boats that were stationary in the water alongside each other. They appeared to be largely empty, with at least two people seen moving before an explosion engulfs both boats. Hegseth said the four vessels were known by our intelligence apparatus, transiting along known narco-trafficking routes and carrying narcotics. The Trump administration has shown no evidence to support its claims about the boats, their connection to drug cartels, or even the identity of the people killed in these strikes. The death toll from the 13 disclosed strikes since early September now stands at least 57 people. In his announcement of the latest strikes, Hegseth also continued to draw parallels between the military's actions against drug trafficking and the war on terrorism following the September 11, 2001 attacks. He claimed that cartels have killed more Americans than Al-Qaeda, and they will be treated the same. Trump has also justified the strikes by asserting that the United States is engaged in an armed conflict with drug cartels and proclaiming the criminal organizations to be unlawful combatants, relying on the same legal authority used by President George W. Bush's administration for the war on terrorism. Maria worked cleaning schools in Florida for $13 an hour. Every 2 weeks, she'd get a $900 paycheck from her employer, a contractor. Not much, but enough to cover the rent in a house that she and her 11-year-old son shared with five families, plus electricity, a cell phone, and groceries. In August, it all ended. When she showed up at the job one morning, her boss told her that she couldn't work there anymore. The Trump administration had terminated Joe Biden's humanitarian parole program, which provided legal work permits for Cubans, Haitians, Venezuelans, as well as Nicaraguans like Maria. "I feel desperate," said Maria, 48 years old, who requested anonymity to talk about her ordeal because she feels being detained and deported. "I don't have any money to buy anything. I have $5 in my account. I'm left with nothing." Trump's sweeping crackdown on immigration is throwing foreigners like Maria out of work and shaking the American economy and job market. It is also happening at a time when hiring is already deteriorating amid uncertainty over Trump's erratic trade policies. Immigrants do jobs like cleaning houses and picking tomatoes, painting fences that most native-born Americans won't do, and they do them for less money, but they also bring technical skills and entrepreneurial energy. Trump is attacking immigration at both ends of the spectrum, deporting low-wage laborers and discouraging skilled foreigners from bringing their talents to the United States. He's also targeting an influx of foreign workers that eased labor shortages and upward pressure on wages and prices at a time when most economists thought that taming inflation would require sky-high interest rates and a recession, a fate the United States escaped in 2023 and 24. Immigrants are good for the economy, said Leigh Brandstetter, an economist at Carnegie Mellon University, because we have a lot of immigration over the past 5 years, an inflationary surge was not as bad as many people had expected. More workers filling more jobs, spending more money, has also helped drive economic growth and create even more job openings. Economists fear that Trump's deportations and limits on even legal immigration will do the reverse. In a July report, researchers Wendy Edelberg and Tara Watson of the Centros Bookings Institution and Stan Vuger of the right-leaning American Enterprise Institute calculated that the loss of foreign workers will mean that monthly U.S. job growth could be near zero or negative in the next few years. Hiring has already slowed significantly, averaging a meager 29,000 a month from June through August. The September jobs report has been delayed by the ongoing shutdown of the federal government. By contrast, employers added 400,000 jobs a month during the post-pandemic hiring boom of 2021 and 23. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, citing fallout from Trump's immigration and trade policies, downgraded its forecast for U.S. economic growth this year from 1.25% from the 1.9% that it had previously expected. This summer, the state of Louisiana texted just over 13,000 people enrolled in its Medicaid program with a link to a website where they could confirm their incomes. The texts were part of a pilot run to test technology the Trump administration says will make it easier for some Medicaid enrollees to prove they meet the new requirements, working, studying, job training, or volunteering at least 80 hours a month, set to take effect in just over a year. But only 894 people completed the quarterly wage check, or just under 7% of enrollees who got the text, according to Drew Moronto, who is the Undersecretary for the Louisiana Department of Health. We're hoping to get more to opt in, Moronto said. We plan to raise awareness. The clock is ticking for officials in 42 states, including those that did not expand the Medicaid bill at all, and Washington, D.C., to figure out how to verify that an estimated 18.5 million Medicaid enrollees meet the rules. Included in Trump's text and spending laws, they still have to the end of the year, and federal officials are giving those jurisdictions a total of $200 million to do so. The policy changes is one of the several to free up money for Trump's priorities, such as increased border security and tax breaks that benefit mainly the wealthy. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office said that the work rules will be the main reason millions of people won't be able to access health insurance over the next decade. It estimates changes to the Medicaid program will result in 10 million fewer Americans covered by the year 2034, more than half of them because of the eligibility rules. For now, state officials, health policy researchers, and consumer advocates are watching the pilot program in Louisiana and another in Arizona. Mehmet Oz, director of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, has touted those test drives and said they will allow people to verify their incomes within 7 minutes. There have been efforts to do this in the past, but they haven't been able to achieve what we can achieve because we have technology now, said Oz during a television appearance in August. Brian Blaze, the president of the conservative Paragon Health Institute and a key architect of Medicaid changes in the new law, has chimed in, saying during a recent radio appearance that with today's artificial intelligence, people should be able to seamlessly enter how they're spending their time. KFF Health News found scant evidence to support such claims. Federal and state officials have offered little insight into what new technology the two pilots have tested. They do say, however, that it connects directly with the websites of Medicaid enrollees' payroll providers rather than using artificial intelligence to draw conclusions about their activities. Oz said the Trump administration efforts started as soon as the bill was signed in July, but work on the pilot programs began under the Biden administration. And Medicaid is a state-federal program. The federal government contributes most of the funds, but it's up to the states to administer them and not the federal government. Oz can say, oh no, we're going to fix this, we're going to do this. Well, they don't actually run the program, said Joan Ataker, a health policy researcher at Georgetown Center for Children and Families. Officials have also offered few details about the pilot's effectiveness in assisting enrollees in Medicaid or other public benefit programs. The shortage of information has some state officials and health policy researchers worried that the Trump administration lacks viable solutions to help states implement the work rules. As a result, they say, people with the legal right to Medicaid benefits could lose access to them. What actually keeps me up at night is the fear that members who are eligible for Medicaid and are trying to get health care services would fall through the cracks and lose coverage, said Emma Sando, Oregon's Medicaid director. From Miami, the federal agent had a daring pitch for Nicolas Maduro's chief pilot. All he had to do was surreptitiously divert the Venezuelan president's plane to a place where United States authorities could nab the strongman. In exchange, the agent told the pilot in a clandestine meeting the aviator would be made a very rich man. The conversation was tense, and the pilot left noncommittal, though he provided the agent, Edwin Lopez, with his cell number, a sign he might be interested in helping the U.S. government. Over the next 16 months, even after retiring from his government job in July, Lopez kept at it, chatting with the pilot over an encrypted messaging app. The untold, intrigue-filled saga of how Lopez tried to flip the pilot has all of the elements of a Cold War spy thriller: luxury private jets, a secret meeting at an airport hangar, high-stakes diplomacy, and the delicate wooing of a key Maduro lieutenant. There was even a final machination aiming at rattling the Venezuelan president about the pilot's true loyalties. More broadly, the scheme reveals the extent and often slapdash fashion to which the U.S. has for years sought to topple Maduro, who it blames for destroying the oil-rich nation's democracy while providing a lifeline to drug traffickers, terrorist groups, and communist-run Cuba. Since returning to the White House, Trump has taken an even harder line. This summer, the president has deployed thousands of troops, attack helicopters and warships to the Caribbean to attack fishing boats suspected of smuggling cocaine out of Venezuela. In 10 strikes, including a few in the eastern Pacific Ocean, the U.S. military has killed at least 43 people. This month, Trump authorized the CIA to conduct covert actions inside Venezuela, and the U.S. government has also doubled the bounty for Maduro's capture on federal narco-trafficking charges, a move that Lopez sought to leverage in a text message to the pilot. I'm still waiting for your answer, Lopez wrote the pilot on August 7th, attaching a link to a Justice Department press release announcing the reward had risen to $50 million. Details of the ultimately successful plan were drawn from interviews with three current and former U.S. officials, as well as one of Maduro's opponents. All spoke on the condition of anonymity because they are either not authorized to discuss the effort or feared retribution for disclosing it. The Associated Press also reviewed and authenticated text exchanges between Lopez and the pilot. Attempts to locate the pilot, Venezuelan General Bitner Villegas, were not successful. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the State Department didn't comment. The Venezuelan government did not respond to a request for comment. The plot was hatched when a tipster showed up at a U.S. embassy in the Dominican Republic on April 24th of 2024, when Joe Biden was president. The informant purported to have information about Maduro's planes, according to three of the officials familiar with the matter. Lopez, who's 50 years old, was then an attaché at the embassy and an agent for Homeland Security Investigations, a part of the Department of Homeland Security. A wiry former U.S. Army Ranger from Puerto Rico, Lopez was leading the agency's investigations into transnational criminal networks with a presence in the Caribbean, after a storied career taking down drug gangs, money launderers, and fraudsters. His work dismantling the illicit money changing operation in Miami even earned him a public rebuke in 2010 from Hugo Chavez, Maduro's predecessor. The embassy assignment was to be his last before retirement. The embassy was closed, although Lopez was still at his desk. He was handed a 3x5 index card with the tipster's name and phone number. When he called, the tipster claimed the two planes used by Maduro were in the Dominican Republic undergoing costly repairs. Lopez was intrigued. He knew that any maintenance was most likely a criminal violation under U.S. law because it would have involved the purchase of American parts, prohibited by sanctions on Venezuela. The planes were also subject to seizure for violating those same sanctions. Locating the aircraft was easy. They were housed in La Isabela Executive Airport in Santo Domingo. Tracing them to Maduro would take federal investigators months. They built that case. They learned that the Venezuelan president had dispatched 5 pilots to the island to retrieve the multi-million-dollar jets, a Dassault Falcon 2000 EX and a Dassault Falcon 900 EX. On to Tucson regional news at 4:15. Fearing a loss of federal dollars, state schools chief Tom Horn wants the Board of Education to immediately start revising the standards used to train teachers in Arizona. Horn noted that an order issued by Republican President Donald Trump on his inauguration day requires states to scrub any references to diversity, equity, and inclusion from programs that receive federal funds. Horn, an elected Republican, contends there are items in Arizona's professional teaching standards that could run afoul of that edict. About $866 million in federal money is at risk, he said. But education board members are not quite as anxious to rush into changing the rules. At a meeting Monday, several said they have serious questions they first want answered. Those include who would be on a committee Horn wants to appoint to go through existing rules to ferret out provisions Trump's administration might find offensive. They put off a decision on crafting new rules until their December meeting. Horn warned that this delay could prove financially hazardous. I'm fearful that if we act too slowly, we may get caught up in a situation where we can't get it done in time and we're facing the axe from the federal government, he said. As to whether there's anything in the existing rules that would endanger federal funding, one possibility deals with the current standards for learning environments. Sid Bailey, an associate school superintendent under Horn, pointed out that one of those requires teachers to manage those environments to actively and equitably engage listeners and learners by organizing, allocating, and coordinating the resources of time, space, and learners' attention. He told the board it may be necessary to excise the words and equitability to comply with the presidential directive. Then there's the provision saying that teachers should communicate in a way that demonstrates respect and responsiveness to the cultural backgrounds and differing perspectives learners bring to the learning environment. All that wording may have to go, Bailey said. He said that's why the rulemaking process must begin with the committee to scour this and all of the rules. I'm not a prophet and can't predict what we'd come up with, said Bailey, but said that the rulemaking process and a study by a committee named by Horn's department would propose revising language that's no longer aligned with current federal directives. Arizona standards are not unique to the state. The State Board here adopted what are known as TASC standards in 2011. That's short for Interstate Teachers Assignment and Support Consortium, whose standards are used to guide education and professional development for teachers across the country. In essence, the standards are meant to make sure that teachers have the knowledge and the ability to ensure all students can learn. Bailey told board members in the 2000 revisions to TASC adopted by the Arizona Board included some key revisions, including emphasis on personalized learning, integration of 21st century skills, and support for diverse student needs. The Republican primary field in the race to replace existing Representative Andy Biggs in Congress took clearer shape with the October 22nd entrance of former Pinal County Sheriff Mark Lamb. It's still early. The candidate's filing deadline to run isn't until April 6th of 2026, and the GOP primary in Arizona's 5th congressional district isn't until August 4th of next year, so the political landscape can still change. But Lamb is seen as the frontrunner because the cowboy hat-wearing sheriff has made numerous national media appearances on Fox News and elsewhere. He's upped his statewide name ID with conservative voters in his unsuccessful 2024 primary bid for the U.S. Senate, which he lost to Carrie Lake, the one-time Phoenix News anchor who has become an ally of Trump and a top MAGA personality. Lamb officially announced his House candidacy on the Charlie Kirk Show podcast, a sign of friendly relationship with the influential conservative organization Turning Point. Other Turning Point figures have cheered his candidacy on social media. And here's what to know about the race as it stands. Biggs, Republican Arizona, is a former Arizona state president who was first elected to the U.S. House of Representatives in 2016. While in the House, he became known as a reliable Trump supporter and served as chair of the conservative House Freedom Caucus from 2019 to 2022. He announced this year that he would run for Arizona governor rather than seek re-election to his sixth term in Congress. He will face another incumbent, U.S. House member Representative David Schweikert, a businesswoman Karen Taylor Robeson, in the 2026 GOP gubernatorial primary election. Trump has endorsed both Biggs and Taylor Robeson in that race. Biggs has yet appointed a potential successor, though he has hosted Lamb on his podcast, What's the Biggs Idea? Trump, the Republican kingmaker, likewise has not yet blessed a candidate in the district's GOP primary. Besides Lamb, several Republican hopefuls have launched campaigns in the 5th Congressional District. Jay Freely, a former kicker for the Arizona Cardinals and a CBS sports analyst, has been in the 5th District race since April and is reasonably well-financed. Daniel Keenan, founder of DK Builders, a home construction company, has signaled a willingness to use his own wealth to fund his campaign. Travis Grantham is a former Arizona legislator who served in the state House of Representatives. He made a previous unsuccessful run for Congress in the 2012 GOP primary in the 9th Congressional District. And Alex Stovall, a U.S. Army veteran, is a Pinal County conservative activist whose campaign website highlights the endorsements of several grassroots conservatives. Arizona State University leaders have offered federal officials ideas on how to advance higher education after several universities decided to sign on to a White House compact that offered preferential treatment for universities if they agreed to a list of demands. ASU has not been asked to join the compact that was offered to the University of Arizona and 8 other schools earlier this month, according to spokesperson Chris Fiskus, who said that ASU has long been a force for change in higher education. If the administration looks for new and innovative approaches to serve the needs of the country, we're a likely one to be asked, he wrote in an email. It's unclear what specific aspects of higher education were discussed with the federal officials. The Compact for Academic Excellence in Higher Education, as titled by the White House, ask universities to create a more welcoming environment for conservative viewpoints, adhere to the federal government's strict definition of gender, and limit international student enrollment to 15%. It also directed universities to freeze tuition for American students for 5 years and limit administrative spending. U of A President Suresh Garamella announced that the university would not sign the proposed higher education compact in its current form, but would continue discussion on how colleges across the country can improve the services they provide and their relationship with the public. Our nation is at an inflection point that requires us to take necessary actions to ensure that American higher education excellence is preserved and indeed strengthened for our rising generation of students and citizens, Garamella wrote in a letter to the Education Secretary Linda McMahon. So how have other universities responded to the White House? According to national media reports, ASU was asked for feedback alongside Washington University in St. Louis and the University of Kansas in mid-October. 7 of the 9 universities that were extended offers to join the compact rejected it, with Vanderbilt University and the University of Texas not yet providing a final answer. Responses are due back to the White House by November 21st. The University of Virginia rejected the White House's compact, saying that, similar to the U of A, that the university would not seek special treatment from the federal government and that the institution would continue to earn its funding based on merit. But the university struck a separate deal with federal officials to pause several civil rights investigations being led by the U.S. Department of Justice. Several national outlets reported that the new College of Florida would sign the Higher Education Compact, which would make it the first to do so. The university was not included in the initial 9 invited to join the agreement. The new College of Florida's Board of Trustees was overhauled by Republican Governor Ron DeSantis in 2023 and includes conservative activist Christopher Rufo. Rufo has led a movement against diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives, particularly in education. And Northern Arizona University, the remaining member of Arizona's public university system, has not been asked to sign or review the White House's compact, according to spokesperson Kimberly Ott. Kyrsten Sinema, former U.S. Senator, had a bleak warning for Chandler: build a data center or have it forced upon you. Sinema said she and her organization, the AI Infrastructure Coalition, are preparing for AI American dominance as they work hand in glove with the Trump administration amidst new priorities. She spoke at a Planning and Zoning Commission meeting during which New York-based developer Active Infrastructure proposed the data center and tech park project called the Price Road Innovation Campus. Chandler right now has the opportunity to determine how and when these new innovative AI data centers will be built, Sinema said. The proposed data center would take over a 40-acre lot in the South Price Road corridor. The lot currently houses a 369,000-square-foot building, which has sat vacant for 6 years. The new data center has one stark difference from the other 10 along the corridor. If approved by the city council, it would be the first AI data center, which focuses more on the intense processing demands of machine learning and AI models. Sinema's comments came after Trump signed multiple executive orders aimed at accelerating data center construction. Earlier this year, the AI action plan set out by Trump administration says it very clearly that we must continue to proliferate AI and AI data centers throughout the country, Sinema said. Federal preemption is coming. The proposed site plan includes the data center and 5 office buildings, ranging from 40,000 square feet to about 71,000 square feet. The data center is expected to be the largest building on the 40-acre site at 422,000 square feet. It lines the western side of the lot. The vacant 369,000 square foot building currently on the site will be demolished in 6 months by the city council approval. No tenants of other buildings have been identified, but the developer proposed a tech hub alongside the data center. City staff worried that those buildings would not be filled. Moving to business at half past the hour, from New York, young job seekers challenged by a rapidly changing labor market are having a tough time. The United States unemployment rate for 22 to 27-year-old degree holders is the highest in a dozen years outside of the pandemic. Companies are reluctant to add staff amid so much economic uncertainty. The hiring slump is especially hitting professions such as information technology that employ more college graduates, creating nightmarish job hunts for the increasingly smaller number who do complete college, not to mention fears that the artificial intelligence will replace entry-level roles. In response, City Foundation identified youth employability as the theme for its $25 million global innovation. This was a challenge that begins this year. The banking group's philanthropic arm is donating $500,000 to each of 50 groups worldwide that provide digital literacy skills, technical training, and career guidance for low-income youth. What we want to do is make sure that young people are as prepared as possible to find employment in a world that's moving really quickly, said Ed Schuyler, City Head of Enterprise Services and Public Affairs. Employer feedback suggested to City Foundation that early career applicants lacked the technical skills that are necessary for roles that many had long prepared to fill, highlighting the need for continued vocational training and the importance of soft skills. Schuyler pointed to the World Economic Forum's recent survey of more than 1,000 companies that together employ millions of people. Skill gaps were considered the biggest barrier to business transformation over the next 5 years. 2/3 of respondents reported planning to hire people with specific AI skills. 40% of them anticipated eliminating jobs that AI could complete. Some grantees are responding by teaching people how to prompt AI chatbots to do the work that can be automated, but Schuyler emphasized it was equally important that they fund efforts to impart qualities AI lacks, such as teamwork and empathy, judgment, and communication. It's not a one-size-fits-all effort where we think every young person needs to be able to code or interface with AI, Schuyler said. What is consistent throughout the programs is we want to develop the soft skills. Among the recipients is NPower, a national nonprofit that seeks to improve economic opportunity in underinvested communities by making digital careers more accessible. Many of their students are young adults between the ages of 18 and 26. NPower Chief Innovation Officer Robert Vaughn said City Foundation's grant will at least double the spaces available in a program for green students with no tech background and oftentimes no college degree. Considering the tech industry's ever-changing requirements for skills and certifications, he said, applicants need to demonstrate wide-ranging capabilities both in cloud computing and in artificial intelligence, as well as project management and emotional intelligence. As some entry-level roles get automated and outsourced, Vaughn said that companies aren't necessarily looking for college degrees and specialized skill sets, but AI comfortability and general competency. It is more now about being able to more than be just an isolated, siloed technical person, he said. You have to actually be a customer service person. Perskolis, the no-cost technology training nonprofit, is another one of the grantees announced on Tuesday. Caitlin Brazil, its president, said that the funds will help develop careers for about 600 young adults across Los Angeles, New York, Orlando, Chicago, and the greater Washington, D.C. area. To keep their classes relevant, she spends a lot of time strategizing with small businesses and huge enterprises alike. City Foundation's focus on youth employability is especially important, she said, because she hears that often AI's productivity gains have forced companies to rethink entry-level roles. Dwindling early career opportunities have forced workforce development nonprofits like hers to provide enough hands-on training to secure jobs that previously would have required much more experience. But if there's no bottom rung on the ladder, it's really hard to leap up, right? Brazil said. She warned that failing to develop new career pathways could hurt the economy in the long run by blocking young people from high-growth careers. Brookings Institution senior fellow Martha Ross said that the fund was certainly right to focus on technology's disruption of the labor market, but she said that the scale of that disruption requires a response that is too big for philanthropy alone. We did not handle previous displacements due to automation very well, Ross said. We've let a lot of people behind, and now we have to decide if we're going to replicate that or not. It is now 35 minutes past the hour. From the opinion page, Craig Miller from the Northwest side writes, "One of the causes of the American Revolution was taxation without representation. I believe Adelita Grijalva's constituents should be exempt from federal taxes for the amount of time that they are without representation due to Speaker Johnson's refusal to seat her." Again, Craig Miller from the Northwest side. Fran McNeely writes, "Adelita Grijalva has been fighting for over a month to represent Southern Arizona in the United States House of Representatives. Juan Ciscomani, on the other hand, only pretends to represent us." And Gloria McMillian from Midtown writes, "The Arizona Daily Star's cover story, ICE raid in Chicago on October 25th, is misleading. This story makes events in my hometown, Chicago, only a crime area problem. Spending that many pages on one raid in Chicago erroneously portrays the Midway Blitz as targeted to a slum area, maybe addressing crime, even if ham-fistedly. However, affluent suburbs are also under ICE's psychological warfare conditions. ICE pulls people from Home Depots as far as Evanston, Illinois. In affluent Palatine, Illinois, WGN-TV interviewed Chappie's owner, Judith Martinez, saying she will close on November 2nd because her Hispanic clientele fear dining there after ICE agents harass customers. Many small businesses in Chicago are seeing a 40 to 50% drop in street traffic trade. Where is that coverage? Is this story echoing that lie about Chicago being a hellhole? While I credit reporters in naming the Wisconsin-based investor slumlord of 7500 South Shore Drive, presenting that single ICE raid as the only Chicago story is incomplete and misleading." Jessica Janicek from Midtown writes, "As a high school administrator rooted in Tucson for over a decade, I support Prop 417. Plan Tucson charts a path for a city where my students can build fulfilling lives. Arizona law requires municipalities to manage growth thoughtfully. Plan Tucson does exactly that for our 242-square-mile city, addressing the needs of over 500,000 residents while planning for growth and protecting our cultural and natural resources. Plan Tucson balances growth with preservation, economic vitality and social equity, and modern innovation with cultural heritage. It enables more residents to age in place and measures success by how well our city serves all, not just some. Our city's future depends on thoughtful planning while ensuring quality of life for generations. I urge fellow Tucsonans to support Plan Tucson 2025. Again, Jessica Janicek from Midtown. Ricker Bechtold from the West Side, "Supposedly Trump uses tariffs as part of an economic plan to improve our economy. American consumers pay the cost of tariffs through increased cost. Canada airs an advertisement quoting Ronald Reagan, who states that tariffs are bad for America. Trump increases tariffs against Canada by 10% because of the TV ad. In part, an economic plan to punish countries that take political positions that he doesn't like. Does governing a nation require the president to punish countries, enemies, and the opposition party? Real presidents govern for all Americans. Kings punish their opposition and dissenters and demand loyalty or else. Trump doesn't govern for all of America. Trump governs based on his ego. He is king because the Republican Congress and Supreme Court make him king and won't do their jobs and reel him in. A king and his sycophants are trying to destroy our nation. They will fail. So wake up. Again, Richard Bechtold from the West Side. Linda Heffernan from Midtown writes that on November 1st, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, food stamps, benefits will cease because of the government shutdown. No matter one's political view, standing passively by while people go without food because elected representatives, who are still being paid and getting their square meals a day, are unable to find a compromise that doesn't endanger people is not acceptable and should not keep us from exercising our humanity. Life without food in the pantry is not patriotic, religious, moral, or ethical. Let's stage a Tucson-style Berlin airlift, known back then as Operative Vittles, Grub. The food bank can be our 747s, and together we can supply the fuel. While donations have the most buying power, every $1 buys 3 meals, healthy, non-perishable food donations work too. And the website has dozens of food drop-off locations. Let's keep this up until SNAP benefits are flowing again, and write your representatives and tell them to get the budget done now. Linda Heffernan from Midtown. Jerry Wilkerson from the Saddlebrook writes, our White House was pert near invincible to attack until Trump. The accumulation of all powers, legislative, executive, and judiciary in the same hands may justly be pronounced the very definition of tyranny. So said James Madison, Federalist 47. Again, Jerry Wilkerson from Saddlebrook. George Timpson from Midtown writes, words are used to obfuscate as well as to communicate, so we need to keep learning. For instance, I've learned to translate artisanal as expensive when I see it. Recently, I've been reading that our president says he is transactional. What does transactional really mean? Why, it means corrupt, of course. Obvious when you think about it. George Timpson. Tom Van Devender from the North Side. The lyrics in Joni Mitchell's classic song in 1971, The Big Yellow Taxi, you don't know what you got till it's gone. They paved paradise and put up a parking lot. Are relevant today. Trump paved the White House, Rose Garden. Now he's destroying the East Wing and Melania's bedroom to build a 90,000 square foot grand ballroom in Mar-a-Lago style, or like King George III's 1770 court. I expect it to be multiple use, a Las Vegas style casino with lots of glitter and bright lights in the summer. And the ice capades in winter featuring precision MAGA gun twirling and a public shooting gallery with video targets of fleeing immigrants. Donald's eyes are teary, thinking of the tourist dollars. What is gone is our wonderful patriotic image of the White House. What we got is trashy Trumpism. So much to restore in the next normal administration. Again, Tom Van Devender from the North Side. Looking at the digest from the National World page, from Washington, House Republicans on Tuesday unveiled their report on former President Joe Biden's use of the auto pen, delivering a blistering critique of his time in office and making sweeping accusations about the workings of his White House. The GOP report does not include concrete evidence that aides conspired to enact policies without Biden's knowledge, or that the president was unaware of laws, pardons, or executive orders signed in his name. But Republicans said that their findings cast doubt on all of the Democrat actions in office. They sent a letter to Attorney General Pam Bondi urging a full investigation. Biden called the GOP claims ridiculous and false. From Chicago, a judge ordered a senior U.S. Border Patrol official on Tuesday to meet her each evening to discuss the government's immigration crackdown in the Chicago area, an extraordinary step following weeks of street confrontations, tear gas volleys, and complaints of excessive force. "Yes, ma'am," responded Greg Bovino, has become the face of Trump administration's immigration sweeps in America's big cities. Bovino got an earful from U.S. District Judge Sarah Ellis, who quickly expressed concerns about a video and other images from an illegal immigration drive that produced more than 1,800 arrests since September. The Senate approved a resolution on Tuesday evening that would nullify Trump's tariffs on Brazil, including oil, coffee, and orange juice, as Democrats tested GOP senator support for Trump's trade policy. The legislation from Virginia, Senator Tim Kaine, a Democrat, passed on a 52-48 tally. Trump's lawyers asked a New York State appeals court late on Monday to toss out his hush money criminal conviction, saying federal law preempts state law and that there was no intent to commit a crime. Trump was convicted in May of 2024 of 34 felony counts of falsifying business records to conceal a hush money payment to an adult film actor. Two Florida University students and an advocacy group for retirees asked a federal judge on Tuesday to let them intervene in a lawsuit filed by young Republican groups challenging the 2020 census results, saying that they worry that the Trump administration won't vigorously defend the case. North Korea said earlier today, that it fired sea-to-surface cruise missiles into its western waters in another display of its growing military capabilities as Trump travels to South Korea for a regional summit. Immigration officials deported a father living in Alabama, 44-year-old Chantia Sean Suvaranath, to Laos, despite a federal court blocking his removal from the U.S. on the grounds he has to claim citizenship, the man's attorneys said on Tuesday. And the Conference Board said on Tuesday its consumer confidence index fell 1 point to 94.6 in October after an upwardly revised September reading of 95.6. Economists were expecting the reading to be unchanged from the previous month. 1 year ago, the reading was 109.5. From San Francisco, a federal judge in San Francisco indefinitely barred the Trump administration on Tuesday from firing federal employees during the government shutdown, saying that labor unions were likely to prevail on their claims that the cuts were arbitrary and politically motivated. Meanwhile, a lawsuit by Democratic state officials on Tuesday seeks to uncork emergency money to help millions of Americans keep buying food for their families after federal SNAP funding is expected to run dry this coming Saturday. The Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, helps about 1 in 8 Americans buy groceries. U.S. District Judge Susan Ilston granted a preliminary injunction that bars the firings while a lawsuit challenging them plays out. She previously issued a temporary restraining order against the job cuts that was scheduled to expire today. Ilston, who was nominated by Democratic President Bill Clinton, says she believes the evidence will ultimately show the mass firings were illegal and in excess of authority. Federal agencies are enjoined from issuing layoff notices or acting on notices issued since the government shut down on October 1st. Ilston said that her order still does not apply to notices sent before the shutdown. The Republican administration slashed jobs in education, health, and other areas, and they say that are favored by Democrats. And the administration also says that it will not tap about $5 billion in contingency funds to keep benefits through SNAP flowing into November. From Washington, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth announced yesterday that the U.S. military carried out strikes in the Eastern Pacific Ocean on four boats that are accused of carrying drugs, killing 14 people and leaving one survivor in the deadliest single day since the Trump administration began its divisive campaign against drug trafficking in the waters off of South America. It was the first time multiple strikes were announced in a single day as the pace of the attacks escalated. The nearly two-month campaign and U.S. military buildup strained ties with allies in the region and opened speculation that the moves are aimed at ousting Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, whom the United States accuses of narco-terrorism. A statement provided by a Pentagon official, who spoke on the condition of anonymity, said the strikes were conducted on Monday off the coast of Colombia. Following one attack on a boat, the military spotted a person in the boat and then in the water, clinging to some wreckage. The military passed the survivor's precise location on to the U.S. Coast Guard and a Mexican military aircraft that was operating in the area. However, the Mexican Navy said it is searching about 400 miles southwest of the Pacific city of Acapulco, suggesting that the possibility that the strike may have taken place far away from Colombia and closer to Mexico's coast. It wasn't immediately clear where the strike took place, and the Pentagon did not give any more detail. EXA said Mexican search and rescue authorities assumed responsibility for coordinating the rescue of the sole survivor, but didn't say if that person was successfully rescued. Mexico's Navy still was attempting a search and rescue operation, the military said in a statement yesterday. Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum said that during her daily news conference, she has asked the Foreign Affairs Secretary and the Navy to meet with the U.S. ambassador in Mexico to discuss the issue because we do not agree with these attacks. We all want international treaties to be respected, she said. The strikes also strained ties with other historic allies, like Colombia, a country whose intelligence is crucial to American anti-narcotics operations in the region. From Washington, Trump's musings about a potential third-term bid for the White House are up against at least one obstacle: House Speaker Mike Johnson. Johnson, the Republican leader who has built his career by drawing closer to Trump, said they discussed the issue, but the speaker held the line against an unconstitutional third term. "I don't see a path for that," Johnson said on Tuesday at his daily news conference at the Capitol. The speaker described how the Constitution's 22nd Amendment does not allow for a third presidential term, and changing that with a new amendment would be a cumbersome, decade-long process winning over states and votes in Congress. The speaker's remarks come as Trump, just 10 months in office in his second term, tests the powers of the presidency in new and often jarring ways, and repeatedly raises the idea of trying to stay in power in the White House. Hats reading Trump 2028 are passed out to lawmakers and others visiting the White House, and Trump's former 2016 campaign manager turned podcaster Steve Bannon revived the idea of a third Trump term. From Deir al-Balah, Gaza Strip, the Israeli army launched a barrage of attacks in Gaza yesterday as tensions with Hamas grew 2 weeks into a fragile ceasefire, and the militant group responded by saying it would delay handing over the body of a hostage. Tank fire and explosions were seen and heard in various parts of Gaza, and at least 7 Palestinians were killed, according to health officials in the territory. The order from Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to launch powerful strikes 18 days into the truce came after an Israeli official said that its forces were fired upon in southern Gaza and after Hamas handed over body parts on Monday that Israel said were the partial remains of a hostage recovered earlier in the war. Netanyahu called the return of these body parts a clear violation of the ceasefire agreement, which requires Hamas to return the remaining hostages in Gaza as soon as possible. Israel notified the United States before launching the strikes on Tuesday, according to two U.S. officials who spoke on the condition of anonymity. Vice President Vance expressed confidence on Tuesday that the ceasefire would hold. Moving to sports, the NBA, in reaction to the arrests of Miami guard Terry Rozier and Portland coach Chauncey Billups last week for their alleged role in gambling schemes, has started a review of how the league can protect not just the integrity of the game, but its players and coaches as well. The league made those revelations in a memo sent to all 30 teams, a copy of which was obtained by the Associated Press. Given the spread of illegal betting in the majority of U.S. states, the recurrence of integrity issues across sports, and the emergence of novel betting formats and markets, this is an opportune time to carefully reassess how sports betting should be regulated and how sports leagues can best protect themselves, their players, and their fans, read the memo sent by the NBA's legal department. Meanwhile, the quest for answers has reached lawmakers in Washington, with the Senate on Monday following a request from a House committee last week and asking the NBA for more information. Senator Ted Cruz, Republican chairman of the Commerce Committee, and Senator Maria Cantwell, the top Democrat on that panel, want information about how the NBA investigated and handled those allegations, as well as what steps the association is taking to maintain the public trust. Their specific questions revolve around the league's probe of Rozier and events surrounding a March 23rd game when he was with the Charlotte Hornets. This committee needs to understand the specifics of the NBA's investigation and why Rozier was cleared to continue playing basketball, Cruz and Cantwell wrote. This is a matter of congressional concern. The integrity of NBA games must be trustworthy and free from the influence of organized crime or any gambling-related activity. They asked Commissioner Adam Silver to provide answers by November 10th. Two indictments were unsealed last week, and nearly three dozen people, most notably Billups and Rozier, were arrested by federal officials. Rozier was arrested because federal officials allege he conspired with associates to help them win bets based on statistical performance in that March 2023 game. The charges are similar to what former Toronto player Jonte Porter faced before he was banned from the league by Silver in 2024. Sportsbooks detected unusual patterns of wagers on the Charlotte game in question. Prop bets involving Rozier were flagged and immediately brought to the NBA's attention, and the league probed the matter but did not find enough evidence to conclude that Rozier broke any rules. And that's the reading of the Arizona Daily Star for Wednesday, the 29th of October. Mark DeGroft with you. Stay tuned for more Sun Sound programming, and I'll be back with you on Friday. Until then, take care.